Hello and welcome to Season 7 of the Art Persists podcast, a series by Bosler Art offering a glimpse into the life of artists and activists from all over the world, here to share their stories with you, the listener. My name's Georgia, I'm the host of this podcast, and to launch Season 7, we bring you a very special episode. This episode was a live recording that took place towards the end of June 2024 as part of Refugee Week in London. The conversation brought together three incredible artists and cultural practitioners, Solomon, Beau, and Sally, each using their work to bring different communities together. I won't say much more, I'll just let you enjoy the episode. But before I go, I just want to say a huge thank you to Counterpoints Arts and Refugee Week for partnering with us. Hope you enjoy. So hello everyone, and thank you so much for being here. Hello everyone here. It's wonderful to have you here as part of Refugee Week with Counterpoints Arts for a live recording of the Art Persists podcast. We are great friends of Counterpoints Arts and love everything they're doing, so it's really fantastic to be here. For those who don't know, Counterpoints Arts is a leading national organisation in the field of arts, migration and social change. And we are Bosler Arts. I co-founded it with Hossam Fazullah, and we, as part of our work, we work with artists and activists and social change makers from all over the world, and we have this podcast as well, which brings together artists and activists, again, from all over the world. So it's a real pleasure to be here speaking to my three incredible panelists. Just to give a brief introduction to each of you, obviously we're going to go into your work in more detail. Beau Holloway is a Nottingham-based independent creative, producer, mentor and consultant who brings together diverse communities, young people, marginalised groups and artists to make art projects about a range of issues. Her work explores race, identity, place and social justice issues. She has worked with Invia Beam, Art for People and Place, Edinburgh Festival and many others, and is currently developing the first youth-led programme for the Imperial War Museum. In 2023, she was awarded a Churchill Fellowship, and this year she researched and interviewed groundbreaking community-focused initiatives using arts for social change internationally and in Chicago in the US. Really looking forward to talking more about that. Solomon, aka KMT, is an exemplar for social change. He's a DJ, MC, and trainer, using arts, in particular hip-hop, for social awareness and cohesion. He entertains and educates, guiding his audiences with infectious energy, knowledge, and skills to change and empower their lives. He's also the co-founder of May Project Gardens, a community-based food growing project set within the grounds of his home. The grassroots project illustrates his passion for proactive social change and love for the environment. And Sally Watkins is co-founder and curator at B-Side. B-Side is an internationally recognised and locally loved arts organisation that both embodies and enriches its place of origin, the Isle of Portland. B-Side invites artists, researchers and residents to create unique and inventive projects inspired by place and people. The current programme, Who Do We Think We Are?, is a collaboration with diverse communities to creatively explore all our stories of migration from around the corner to across the globe. So welcome. Thank you so much all for coming.
Thank you.
Before we get into it, could you maybe each tell me a bit about your background, how you got to where you're going, and a bit more about yourself? Sally, why don't you take it away?
Oh, it's really lovely. Thank you so much for inviting me and B-Side to be here. I was here on Monday and it was an incredible day, so it's really exciting to be back. So I grew up on the Isle of Portland in Dorset. And like lots of people of my generation, it was a bit of a sort of dead-end place to live. Luckily for me, I met some interesting folk who came to move to the area, and I ended up moving away with them. And in my late 20s, studied theatre performance at Dartington College of Arts and then taught there for a number of years, as well as doing lots of other things in between and having my own practice as an artist. Like lots of people, I moved back, which is a really common story to hear for where I come from in Dorset. And I moved back to bring up my son. Actually, I hadn't intended to move back entirely. I came back for maternity, but Dartington closed down while I was there. So I stayed. And at the time, it was a bit of a There wasn't really a lot happening in the arts. It was very ad hoc. Lots of artists moved to Dorset, but tend to live kind of quite sort of separate, independent lives. And I was there in 2008 when the Olympics were announced for the UK and the sailing events would be taking a place in Weymouth and Portland. And so a group of us got together and thought, because there was the Cultural Olympiad runs for the 4 years before, thought that it might be a great opportunity to get some regularly funded art happening in the area. So we set up B-Side, really with a view to just seeing how it would go for a few years. And we set it up very much with it. If you don't know Weymouth, it's a really, really touristy, that's the seaside town just before you get to the island of Portland. It's a very seasidey town. And we wanted to kind of look at the non-commercial side of our area and where we lived. And that's why it's called B-Side as opposed to A-Side.
Thank you so much. Well, how about you?
Well, I'm going to go back sort of to my childhood a little bit because that's a bit of an influence. So because I don't work as part of an organisation, I'm freelance. So I'm going to go back to me as a kind of child, really, because I grew up in Essex, mainly. Went to a comprehensive school where there were hardly any black people there. So it's quite a tough environment. I had a lot of encouragement from my art teacher, so I felt like I was quite lucky in that sense of getting that somebody seeing something in me and being encouraged at a young age. And then decided to, after a lot of persuasion from this art teacher that I can't remember her name, but she was amazing, applied to do like a BTEC in general art and design in Essex. And then I originally studied at it was called the Norwich School of Art Graphic Design, because I was quite interested in design and every day, you know, using creativity in that kind of way, but kind of changed my mind after graduating quite a lot from graphic design to illustration to being quite interested in using creativity to work with people. And I moved back from Essex to Norwich, where I originally was living there as a student to work in an artist-led space where I did a bit of everything. You weren't really paid much as a volunteer, but was really gravitating towards supporting people who were sort of volunteering. A lot of them were kind of adults getting into that world, and I was just more drawn to working with people rather than being a exhibitions curator. So yeah. It kind of stemmed from there, but I've always had that kind of drive towards kind of helping others. You know, I'm quite an empath, and I think all the things I experienced growing up, kind of racism and classism, etc., made me want to move more into working in the arts and using kind of the arts for social change. And I ended up moving to Nottingham in a kind of random way. I won't go into the story, it's too long and complicated. And sort of got into small gallery jobs there and really got working sort of gallery education until I no longer wanted to work in an institution because I found it too restrictive and I wasn't comfortable with the processes. So I ended up going freelance quite a few years ago, 2013, and haven't really looked back since because I kind of found that I could work in that more person-focused way and collaborate with artists and not necessarily work in a venue, but be based in a community and, you know, be based anywhere working with people or young people or diverse communities. So that's my way into kind of working in the arts.
Thank you so much. Solomon, how about you?
Yeah, so thank you first and foremost for being here. And again, for Cal Poets and Bosla for hosting the space. I was here again on Monday and I was like, to drag me out to another event where I'm not working, I was a bit like, oh man, Deanna, like, you know, but it was really amazing. I'm glad I came. So it made me reflect a lot and think about things differently. Side note, I do a lot of that. Apologize. So my background was in music, but specifically in hip hop music. I was mainly a DJ and promoter, and I was very interested in using hip hop, but I got quite disillusioned by the sexism, the male ego, the gatekeepers, all of that in the scene. So although I was in the scene, I just found it really difficult to bring spaces or create spaces that really reflected what I wanted to do. At the same time, I was also working community settings, the third sector. So I was working for various charities doing community work. And I also got frustrated by the fact of the lack of promotions in the organisation. So one example was we did this project and the person who I was kind of mentoring and developing got a promotion beyond me and then was managing me the following year. And I was like, how did this even happen? We know why it happened. And I just was getting really sick and frustrated by that. But that, as a background, then coincided with someone moving into my home in 2006. My mum passed away in 2005. Someone passed moved into my home in 2006 who was a permaculture gardener. And I was like, whoa. Like, I was just like, watched him get into the garden and started to just transform my rough and ready dusted garden into like a food growing space. And I was like, this is amazing. And that is really where my journey started. I never started. So I used my home for a project and I never started in the environmental sector as a true person that was into the environment. It was just really when I felt there was a gap in the community work and also the music, this kind of filled that void. It kind of really was like, this is what I need. This makes me feel, makes the music, makes the community work felt more complete. So then I started really getting into that work. So that's my start of my journey. So the project's called May Project Gardens. It's been running for 17 years and it still operates and it still operates in my home in Southwest London.
It's incredible, and we're going to talk about it more in a second. And I think what the reason that we wanted the three of you to come is that there is this thing that connects all three of you, which is working so deeply and closely with communities. And this idea of, you know, the theme of Refugee Week this year is our home. And home obviously means different things to different people. But what I've definitely found as a driver for why I want to work in the arts is because it can create this sense of home and it can bring people together. It can offer people different ideas and different understandings and enable people to look beyond, you know, their life, their view, whatever it may be. So before we get into specifically talking about your work, I was wondering if I could ask each of you to just kind of reflect on what the theme of our home means to you or how it relates to the work that you each do in different but similar ways.
I when I saw that question, I had slightly different interpretations of it, because when you talk about our home, I think about being at home. It can be a physical space, like your own home. So my own home where I live in, I'm based in Nottingham, and I'm very lucky to live. I rent a one-bedroom Victorian flat in a conservation area. Yeah. And so I feel at home there with lots and lots of plants. I don't have a garden, but I've got a lot of house plants. So I feel at home there, and where I live in Nottingham, it's, you know, it's got a very nice community feel, but I can feel at home anywhere where I feel accepted, or I felt at home on projects where I work with, I don't know, young people or particular groups that I work with and artists, so we're all there together on the same wavelength, as it were. So I can feel at home in that way, but I could feel at home in very different spaces. Yeah. I think I don't have a set idea of what is. Well, I think in a different way of what is home. And I know you're going to ask me about it later, but I spent a month in Chicago recently and I felt very, very at home there, because I'd never had that opportunity to stay somewhere for 4 weeks and it felt quite sad to come back. So I've got different perspectives on home, I guess.
Yeah, of course. And I think that's what's nice. It's more of it's actually quite hard to articulate the feeling of feeling truly comfortable and also just being able to be yourself in the space. Sally, what about you? Anything come to mind?
Yeah, I often feel when I'm on the island that I have a huge resistance to being there. So although it's supposedly my home, it's also somewhere that I wrestle with quite a lot. And I think what makes it an amazing place to be is when it becomes temporary homes through some of the projects that we do there. So it comes alive in a, not in a domestic way, but in a kind of different kind of meaningful way. A little bit like Bo was saying, really, I think it's the feeling at home rather than it being home. And also I was thinking that we've had quite a lot of conversations recently as a group of people on the island who were working a lot with asylum seekers about what home means in that context, in a hyper-temporary kind of place where people are sometimes arriving and, you know, going in the middle of the night and, you know, with no knowledge of how long they're going to be on the island. So I think we've been talking a lot about creating atmospheres of home or safe spaces that feel like home. And I think for a lot of us that are living there more permanently, those for me feel like that's where I feel at home too, you know, in those kind of temporary spaces. Yeah.
Absolutely. And Solomon, obviously you have this incredible project within your own home, and how, but I imagine that it's also a space of home for other people who are part of the project. So how do you reflect on the theme?
Yeah, I think it's for me, I think I've never felt at home, like, if that makes sense. I've never really, in the UK, despite being born here and being bred up here, it never felt, I just suppose, injustice and just seeing poverty, refugees, just all these people that you just see that are beautiful human beings just not being treated humanely. So I feel like I've never really felt at home in this physical, even my home. So I suppose making my home a space where I'm creating that atmosphere where people are welcomed is what home is for me. I think it's a real struggle for me to come out of my space. I think it's a bit of a, so saying on Monday, I was like, oh, Deanna, like, I was to come out. She's like, come to this event on Monday. And I'm like, oh man, like, I've got to come out of my house and travel the tube and da 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 da. And it was like, it's a real effort for me now to come out of my home because I've created my home now. I've created a space. And in doing that, hopefully I've kind of created a home for people that don't have a home. And we'll talk a little bit more about the Straw Bale classroom that came out of that, where the refugees, the asylum seekers built. And that was in response to them not feeling like their home was a home. And I know what that feels like. So I was like, let's build that home. So, yeah.
Yeah, maybe you can actually, now would be a nice opportunity for you to tell us a bit about that project and what exactly it was and how... Yeah, tell us a bit more about what happened.
So I suppose for me, my work is, the art is solutions based. It's not entertainment. Like, it's not, we're not coming to entertain anybody. It's about, we use the garden in particular for this cohort. This was a cohort of young refugees at the time. And so we used nature as a tool to bring the context. But there was an association with nature, with poverty. So it didn't have that same impact that we wanted for them. So what it did instead, it actually became a healing space for them to deal with their issues. So they managed to produce some music called Freedom Now, which I played at the event, I can't remember, last Tuesday, when was it? There was an event recently, DJs with someone, young person at the back was performing. So I played it there. But specifically with the Straw Bale classroom, they were saying that they don't have a home. Like, they are treated inhumanely. Like, they're treated like second class, worth, just the stories you're hearing. I mean, they're so normalised in the conversations with young refugees and asylum seekers. They make light of it. But you're just like, empathic, you're just like, what? Like, this is disgusting. Like, this is disgusting. So, as usual, me being this, a bit of a crazy individual, I was like, all right, we're going to build you a classroom, but you can build your own homes. Da-da-da-da-da. I had no idea how to do it. No idea. But actually, something about the process of community, there's kind of like, I call it a mycelium network, where you kind of work with the idea of what you want to do. And in the process of trying to achieve that goal, you meet people who you need to meet. And I've seen that happen more and more. And so I met Deanna and Deanna Paulina, who also works for Counterpoint Arts as well, in a community space. I think it was it your event, Margate?
It was Folkestone.
It was. That's right. So that was the connection. And it was really interesting. We just had this conversation. I brought my Apple Press. That's the way I like to engage people. Like, bring an Apple Press. Let's do Apple Press in. And Dana and Paulina were talking about their work.
And we just had this conversation and transpires that they wanted to do a natural build. And I was like, well, we've got these young refugees that want to do something. Let's do it. We were just like, yeah, no problem. Let's get on with it. And just, you know, not take up too much time, we did create it. It wasn't an easy process. It was a really challenging project. But the point being is that now it's been built. The Daily Mail had a feature on it about 3-4 months ago about this being the future of housing. And I just want to just really drill into that, because I feel like people on the edges of society bring so much, and that's our model. Like, we always work with the people. And so how I really want to kind of like highlight this is because they've possibly created a solution to the housing crisis in the UK and globally, but yet people are not investing in these young people and communities that are on the edge of society that are bringing innovation. They're bringing problems, and in their problems, they're bringing solutions. And so this is one example of how we work. So that was that project.
It sounds just amazing. And for anyone in the audience, there are some photos here where you can see more, maybe at the end. And Bo, obviously you work a lot with young people as well. Mm-hmm. And a lot of your projects also comes this idea of, you know, giving young people the freedom to create, I guess, yeah. And this kind of empowering young people through, you know, sort of like you said, where your teacher just believed in you, and how yeah. like that can also just, I remember as a young person, just having one person saying, you're good at this, you can do this, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. You had a project called You Can't Ignore Us, working with Year Nines in Castleford, and it came up with this a beautiful zine of their work that they created with the issues that mattered most to them. Can you tell us a bit more about this, and also just how you work with young people and how you instill this kind of power to create with them?
Well, that project was actually a commission by INNOVA, Institute of Visual Arts in London. So the project was really about, I suppose, exploring museums, but how do they actually relate to people living around them? Because museums would have collections and events and programs, but how does that relate to, say, young people aged, I don't know, 13 upwards and their actual lives? You know, if you've got a museum that's got a specific collection, but how does that relate to what is around it? And we were originally partnered with the Hepworth Museum in Wakefield to look at their collections and visit, but actually we ended up working in a very different way. And just to actually say that I'm a producer, but I work collaboratively with artists. So I'm not, as somebody said to me, you're quite unusual, because a lot of the producers that I work with, they're like behind the desk, whereas you will come and support artists. I always end up as a kind of co-facilitator. I'm a big really supporting artist as well. So I thought that was quite normal, but they said, no, people don't do that usually in the office, or they don't come with us. They just, here it is, you get on with it, goodbye. Yeah. I'll see you at the end. So I worked with this spoken up word artist called Simone Yasmin, based in Leeds. And it was also quite rare, the project had funding for an art therapist. So we were going into this classroom for a 2-hour session, which was very, very complicated because half the class had to go after an hour, which was quite messy. Mm. But, Simone produced this kind of set of questions around, you know, calling the students artists and exploring working class people and working class artists and their role in the arts and museums, and looking at that question of, you know, how do we fit in, or what we should be part of this system, and, you know, there's all these sort of privileges against us, etc. But we literally looked at the young people as artists and looked at, you know, not just the museum, but what subjects matter to them, and exploring that creatively. So the actual zine has all these kind of, topics that they were interested in, like, you know, being a working class artist, to class, to racism, to, you know, one of the young people was exploring global conflicts and saying, you know, why are we so open to Ukrainian refugees when there's all these global conflicts going on, and she actually started researching all of them.
Wow.
And put them into her collage work. And all these kids were like white working class kids, 13 to 14 year olds. Yeah. And I was, you know, completely blown away, not because of their knowledge, but because of, I remember myself at that age not being politically aware, and they were so advanced. They were talking about Black Lives Matter, they were talking about all kinds, trans rights, everything. So I think being part of those sessions, all three of us were there to really walk around and encourage the young people to, you know, be creative. And Simone used all kinds of interesting techniques, like looking at rap artists like Dave to encourage writing. So, you know, looking at writing in a very different way, like lyrics and poetry, to encourage them to write or create, which I'd never seen that. So we're sitting there and she's playing a clip of Dave performing at the Brits. So it was just a really interesting way to get those young people to feel like, you know, we are artists, we're creatives, and you know, you're kind of walking around and you're noticing the ones that we require. Or there was somebody who was like a refugee that was, there might have been Ukraine, I can't remember, but you know, you can spend time with each of them. So we were all there kind of really encouraging those young people to kind of express their opinions and create this thing. So that's, with that project, that's how I kind of work on projects, in a very collaborative, linear way, and let the project move how it wants to.
Yeah.
I think that's because I'm freelance now, so I don't really ask anymore. It's kind of, well, the project's going like this. So whoever I'm working with is, you know, we seem to be going in this direction, and then we produce, it was part of the project for us to produce something like a permanent artwork. So we had the zine and framed some of the artwork in the school. So yeah, I've got a copy of it to show people if people want to have a look.
Yeah, it's really, really beautiful. So we can definitely have a look after. Thank you so much. And Sally, of course, your co-founder and curator at B-Side Arts, and one of your projects, Who Do We Think We Are, explores ancestry, identity and personal histories. And I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about how you work with communities there, but also what you may have discovered through the participation of the community within projects, either that project or similar projects with your work.
Yeah, so Who Do We Think We Are comes out of many, many years of working quite deeply with our community on Portland. As I said, we started off with Weymouth and Portland, but we moved to the island, which, if you don't know, it is quite a small island, but it's quite densely populated. It's got an amazing biodiversity. It's really famous for Portland stone. A lot of London's built from Portland, which in itself is kind of quite a controversial thing, because it's an island where a lot of the island has been taken away from it. And what it's been left with is quite an intense poverty. But it's also really well known for its kind of natural history. So lots of bird watchers go there, lots of walkers, geologists. So it's got, and so people who live on the island, whether they're people who've lived there for many generations or people who choose to, you know, take up their life on Portland, the landscape itself has quite a huge impact. To give you a kind of little example, we have a lot, you know, like we're on the south coast, we get a lot of storms. Chesil Beach is really well known for its big storms, and everybody comes out to watch the rough sea, you know, pretty much wherever you are. And if you go onto the Facebook, local Facebook pages, they are just full of stormy pictures or sunsets. Everybody loves the landscape, and it draws lots of people. And also because it's not overdeveloped as a tourist destination. So lots of people go there for a kind of quiet life as well. And one of the things we found with making work on the island is that whether you're a sort of permanent resident or a temporary resident as an artist or a researcher, it's almost impossible to get away from the impact that the environment has on you. And it was a biennial festival, it's now an annual festival. So we commission artists to make work that's in response to the island, whether it's the ecology or the history or people and communities. And that includes people from the island as artists. So it's our open call goes out. So it might be national, international or resident artists. But what a lot of people feel like, I think, both as residents and artists, is that the intensity of being on this island kind of really informs the way the work that's made. And over the years, we started to notice more and more that the groups that we were working with were talking about what we were doing in a way that perhaps we weren't talking about it ourselves. And we did a research project for a few years, a kind of longitudinal study, and which sounds really pompous, actually, because it was just like lots of really lovely conversations with different groups. But what was really striking was how people talked about what B-Side was doing. And we really want to be responsive. I mean, quite a few of us are from, you know, if not from Portland, but from Dorset. And so we really wanted to kind of let that start to inform more and more of the process that we work with, but also to sort of relinquish control over the organisation a bit. So, you know, we're an NPO, so we've got some quite kind of formal structures that we follow, but we also have a lot of other ways of working which are far less formal on the island. And a lot of people are very involved in the kind of informalities of making a festival work. So, you know, we have all the kind of the right people in place, but, you know, if we need a lead, we can knock on someone's door, or, you know, somebody who's a friend of B-Side can go and knock and ask someone else. It's got that kind of feel to it, which is very appealing to artists. And Who Do We Think We Are came out of, so we've got an overarching program called Common Lands, which for 2 years was looking at our relationship to place and the ecology, well, the natural and the built environment of Portland. And the second part, which has started now, which is looking at all our stories of migration and identity. But that really comes from the work and the artist work that has already been made. We were noticing that artists who were applying to us were really engaging deeply with the communities and individuals on the island. And that's almost like every single festival for perhaps up to a year or more before the festival, different socially engaged arts projects that might look at the impact of climate on the island. But all these subjects were kind of like looking at Portland as a microcosm for something sort of international. And it was a kind of natural fit to really to start to ask these questions long before the Bibby came. So the Bibby Stockholm has kind of put a different complexity on it, but actually Who Do We Think We Are was really about how we start to talk to each other about these stories that are actually, you know, because we're a very high Brexit voting area as well, so some real discomfort around those conversations around migration, but really joyful conversations when it's through art. Somehow that seems to make everything, you know, it's an opportunity to be excited by what movement can mean, as well as really drill down into some of the real sadnesses of that too.
And you mentioned the Bibby Stockholm Barge. Could you maybe just tell us a little bit, tell people about it, for those who may not know, and your relationship to it as well?
Yeah, so, I mean, if those of you don't know, the Bibby Stockholm is a floating barge sort of ship type thing that's moored in Portland Port. It was announced in April 23 that it was coming to the island. It was a private port, so no permissions were needed from the councils. So the councils didn't know. It was just an agreement made between the port and the Home Office. It was really controversial when it was announced. It was going to be up to 500 men on a barge that was designed for 250. So it was adapted to squash as many people in as possible. It was only there for a week before there was a Legionella's outbreak. So people were moved off, but then very soon came back. And, you know, it has very sadly created huge division on the island, I think made worse by enormous amounts of publicity and press there every day, and lots of, you know, far-right groups visiting the island and whipping up a lot of, you know, anger and frustration, I think, as well, but also, you know, a lot of nastiness. However, the flip side of that is the one of the most amazing groups called the Portland Global Friendship Group, set up instantly and is like phenomenal at providing what probably should be statutory services, but from everything from like games nights, film nights, walks, cookery sessions, English lessons, clothing, you know, creative writing, all kinds of things. So B-Side's been part of that group. So we've been doing activity. We have a risograph printer, so we're doing risograph workshops. What we've tried to do is there's a little pot of funding called Community Connections, So all our activities whereby the guys from the Bibby participate and people from the island are invited to participate. So we've got film clubs, we did a film night for Refugee Week, our risograph workshops, creative writing, which is on the barge. So I think we're the only group that have been able to go onto the barge to work, which was really important to us because I think only about 50% of the guys come off the barge, despite the overwhelming number of activities being off. I mean, it's all in a really small area as well. So, you know, you have to be bussed in and out because it's a port, but it's actually all like within walking distance, really. And I think one of the most interesting groups, particularly in terms of this conversation around home, has been the my colleague Rocker runs a group called Artichat, which is an LGBT group, which has enabled the queer community in Portland who weren't a group, there was no kind of existing group, to have a space to meet along with guys from the Bibby. And that's been an amazing group because we've had some fantastic artist nights there, most recently with Tom Marshman looking at Section 28. Memories of that and looking at comparisons in different parts of the world. So really, really amazing kind of opportunities. And despite all the negativity, we haven't actually experienced any as B-side. We've only had people come and say how brilliant it is that this is, has become part of the Who Do We Think We Are project. It's just very natural fit.
Well, it sounds really, I can only imagine how the kind of horrible tensions that it creates, but it also shows that through art, there is a way to bring people together, and it's good to hear that, you know, people from that, some people from the island also participate. So, yeah, really incredible work. Thank you so much.
Hi, this is Hossam Fazula, co-founder of Bosla Arts. The Art Persists podcast is independently run by Bosla Arts, me and Georgia, which allows us to share these important conversations with artists and activists from all over the world. In order to keep having these conversations, we need your help. Join us on Patreon for as little as £3 and help us continue this vital work. More info in the episode description. Now back to the podcast.
Solomon, I wanted to talk to you about this idea of reconnecting people to nature for personal, social, and economic transformation. And you mentioned before this, I guess, relationship between poverty and access to nature. Could you maybe tell us a bit about that and how you work to reconnect people?
So within my home, because I think the way in which the arts funded world is set up is to be quite short term. Like, you know, you do a project, You stop, start. And to me, that was why I didn't want to, that's why I created my own project, to avoid that. Mm-hmm. It's unavoidable unless you've got a really good team of funding in place or strategy. You know, it's just the nature of it is. So ultimately what happened is that different projects emerged from the garden. So I think one example of what's happening here is that I look at individuals and organizations as hubs. So I always use nature metaphors rather than when you say, like, you're doing community work, there's this kind of funding world where you say you do one activity and then you get one outcome. But that never happens. Like, you do one activity and there's like 20,000 outcomes. Sometimes you can't always measure them, you know? So looking at that, so we have that. Hip Hop Garden was the Strawbell Classroom, which is our youth program. Cumbria Grove is our event. Deanna's attended quite a few of those. So ultimately, nature runs through all the themes of the work we do. I think it was before climate change became an issue, before Sustainable Goals stepped in, we were already doing this work. And that just came as a result of, I just saw the potential of this being a really good tool for healing, for health, for creative arts, all these multiple outcomes, which when we look at historically, our cultures globally is what we did. We never really separated nature from the arts. And suddenly we've got into this thing of nature art. And it's just like, well, just look at this leaf behind you. How beautiful is the art of nature? Yeah. Music, how beautiful is the songs of the birds, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So nature for me and the project is just something that runs throughout. And so personal is more the, it depends where you're coming from, but I believe that when you come into our space, very often what happens is people, in order to get healed, they bring their worst self before they get better. Does that make sense? And you have to hold them in that space. So because they've never been in a space where there's love or support or help, they, it's almost like they vent, or they just, they let their negativity, they basically poo. They poo in the space. They release their feces, you know, which is emotional, whatever it is. So you've got to do that as the personal. Then you can take them on their journey. We do that first. We don't focus on the project. We focus on the well-being. That's always very important. We start with the people, not with the environment side of it. And then the social is about, you know, how do we do that communally? Like, you know, what activities do we do as a space? You know, food, buddying, conversations, just giving people time. Those social things, again, which are in fundamental to communities globally. Like, I love hearing different community practices because you're seeing the same themes. And yet people ask me, what are you doing in communities? What is community work? I'm doing some work on a separate level for the council, but it's like, how do we value communities? You know, everyone's like, you know, you're a doctor, you go through this process, you get loads of money. I was saying that with community work, it's one of those things you can start up doing washing dishes and helping people, and you could do 20 years experience, you could still end up doing washing dishes. It's interesting how it's very downplayed in terms of the experience of community work and the undervaluing of it as well. And then the economic, I think particularly for, and this relates to not just the refugees, but people who won't get their real opportunities to be fully included in society, economics, creating jobs and opportunities, not just jobs, is crucial. So with the class, the Strawbell classroom, they got paid to work on the classroom, and they also got qualifications as well. We try to work in a way where anyone that comes as part of our program, we try to work in a way, I don't know if I show this online, but to ensure money is kind of given to them, because they can't take money technically. But it's like, how can we have this big pot of money from a grant and not give it to the people that are on the beneficiaries? It's just it's lunacy. And so that's constantly how we work. So that's the economic side. And those snapshots run through every single element of what we do. So, yeah.
It's really incredible work. And obviously you've been running for, I think you said, 17 years. Yeah. When you reflect on those 17 years, can you tell us, like, are there any moments that stand out from that time that really, I know it's a hard question, but that really make you either happy or smile? Is there any moments that really stand out for you?
There's a quote, it's on my Instagram, and I'm dyslexic, so I paraphrase everything really badly. So I'm going to say it, but it was something along the lines of the role of a mature person is to celebrate grief and joy simultaneously. If you focus on grief, you become detached, you become distressed, you become, you know, despondent, you become negative, you know, yourself. But if you have too much joy, you know, like these people, like, yeah, we are the world, da 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 da. Yeah, we are, but there's problems that we need to deal with. Like, if you have too much of that, you become saccharine and you don't actually engage. So that's kind of where it is for me. It's like just really having that balance of, or just not even balance, but the understanding that with great pain comes great joy. So one example of that, one of the young people in the Strawbell project is not here no longer. And that brings me great pain. But also gives me great joy that we can hopefully create a legacy for him through this project. And that's my aim, to kind of really, his folks don't even know that he was part of this project. And, you know, hopefully at some point I'll go back to visit his parents and say, well, look, this is what he created. And it is a possible solution for the housing crisis. Whether that happens, who knows? But that's not, just to show them that there is also joy from adversity as well. So, yeah, that's, yeah, how I look at it.
Thank you so much for sharing that. And I can really relate, because I think in any way that anyone experiences it, grief and feel, you know, the worst feelings you can have are also ones that teach you how important it is to feel joy, to improve the world in whatever way you see it. And Yeah, so I really relate. Thank you for sharing. Well, you've obviously just come back from Chicago. You spent a month there, and where you got funding from the Churchill Fellowship. And you looked at how Black-led art initiatives and organizers are using radical approaches to bring about social change. And I'm so interested just to know from you what you discovered, how you reflect on it. Tell us a little bit about your experience and what you learned from that.
Well, I mean, the award, basically, before I went to Chicago, it's actually in two parts where I also looked at other initiatives that are community focused, working with young people, but working in a very collaborative way, using creativity as a problem solver or transform neighbourhoods or transform people's lives. I was looking at organisations around the world and interviewing those people online. But my time in Chicago, as I say, I was there for 4 weeks, but it was in May, so it's quite fresh. But I basically interviewed, I think most of the organisations were actually Black-led initiatives, but there were some organisations that, you know, they were diverse, or they might have a white director, but they were working in very diverse areas. And it was very interesting to look at how politically the actual Chicago is divided up, because it was very, and the people I interviewed said this, segregated. They said, don't be thinking this is a kind of liberal city. So I was interviewing organisations where, you know, you go into one area of Chicago and it's predominantly Black neighbourhood, and you'd be on the L train, which is their metro system, and everybody white's got off and it's just white or Puerto Rican people. And it's, you know, I kind of got used to that. But yeah, I'd go to one area, I interviewed a organisation called Alt Chicago in Austin, who were doing, they set up this like grassroots initiatives working with young people in the Black community, working across the community, but also doing things like neighbourhood transformation. So there were issues like there were no bins in that area. So lots of people talked to me about, you know, predominantly Black areas were deliberately disinvestment was going on with transport, etc. So the area had no bins. So the two guy founders designed bins with the community. They also designed an alternative food bank. So there was a shop unit that used to be a supermarket that closed down, and they worked with the community to design this almost like a wooden open plan cupboard that would open up. They'd put supplies on there. You take what you want and leave what you want. People could donate, and then they'd close it up. So it's a really interesting, you know, creative, sort of very positive kind of way of working. And one of the founders also showed me what was going to be their new community space. He said, oh, I'll just take you around the corner to our new community space, which was this massive bank. It used to be a bank, like built in the 1920s. And I said, oh, this is going to be our community space. It's like huge. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of actual repurposing old buildings, a lot of organisations. They didn't build new, they'd go refurbish new spaces for the community. I interviewed someone else who had an art space that was in a residential area, and it was just a massive house. So they had, you know, exhibitions, but they also worked with the community along that road and in the street, but they also were doing things around rewilding residential areas, patches of grass, and turning them into, you know, veg patches and introducing trees. There was another organisation I worked with that was looking at town planning, citywide planning, but doing it in collaboration with local residents, but doing it in a creative way. So it was the first approach of its kind. Yeah. So it's really fascinating to interview those people. And there were a couple of things that came up and phrases that came up that people talked about working with people and communities, about working at the speed of trust. So everything is about long-term initiatives and projects, and not short-term solutions, or not projects in response to or inspired by. It's okay, what does the community need? how much time is it going to take for us to even build that trust? You know, basically going out and talking to people like months. And it was just all the things that I kind of wanted to hear and see, but people doing it in quite a radical way. And I also talked to them about, well, how do you fund in these things? And, you know, lots of different ways of funding, from getting, I suppose, money equivalent to Arts Council, but it wasn't a lot, but a lot of it was philanthropic and sponsors, donations, and lots of fundraising events. Yeah. They'd do that. So they'd all keep to their principles of, you know, we're working this very long-term supportive structure in these very, you know, very specific ecosystems, neighbourhoods that are, you know, they're described as neighbourhoods, but in Chicago, there's 77 different neighbourhoods. Yeah. So you might go to one neighbourhood that would be very Puerto Rican or Latin. You go to one neighbourhood, you get off the train, rainbow flags everywhere. Mm-hmm. Go to one neighbourhood, this is very, you know, trendy, gentrified. You know, you could really very see the, you know, how different every neighbourhood was. So there was all these initiatives going on in these different spaces. And originally I was going to interview more, but I ended up interviewing sort of four organisations. But I, in my head, I was thinking, well, it's not about the quantity, it's the quality rather than the quantity. So it was a very profound experience that I'm kind of transcribing a lot of these interviews, and we'll produce a report. But like I say, before I went to Chicago, I was interviewing people online, doing this kind of work in Singapore. There was an arts initiative there where, I won't go through all their projects, but they had this amazing project called Living Well, Leaving Well, which was all about end-of-life conversations and a creative project working with elders in care homes. So I've never seen that approach before, thinking about, you know, living well and, you know, death essentially.
Yeah.
And that intergenerational working and the fact that elders hadn't had that kind of conversations before. Interviewed someone else in Colombia that had originally worked with, set up a project in their house that they bought, and they had street children hanging around outside that they ran a kind of film clubs, and now they've developed this massive youth-led program and with thousands of young people. Another project, interviewed someone in Rotterdam looking at temporary housing, but it was looking at how a lot of the campsites in this area in Rotterdam were being used as temporary housing by people who were, you know, on low incomes, refugee and asylum seekers, but they weren't recognised as permanent homes, and working with those communities there to look at an alternative solution. So, you know, it was kind of a real privilege to get to talk to these people about their approaches, and, you know, some were very, very unconventional. Like an artist collective that looked at the concept of care in society, I thought it was going to be people in care homes, but it's actually about the concept of work. And they would work shadow dustmen, like they'd turn up and work with them for months and months and months and produce a project with them, and cleaners and nurses. And, you know, it's just this, everything was about time. Some, you know, they weren't very well paid. A lot of these organisations weren't well funded, but the key thing was about, you know, time and building trust, and this is what the outcome can be, and empowering communities to continue that work, and also being very self-reflective and self-critical. Because when we look at evaluation here, we'll talk about what's the you know, outcomes for participants, and they would talk about well, it's not about it, it's important, but how do we change? How have I changed as an individual? Let's pause funding. Some people would have these discussions with funders and say, you've asked us to deliver this, but actually we want to pause it for 6 months and look at what we're doing. And I was like, I can't imagine that. Yeah, we would just talk to them. They don't like it, but we did it. So it was just really, it was amazing to talk to those people. I was kind of so in awe of them that when they started asking me about my work, I was kind of, I'd kind of forgotten to think it's a two-way conversation, because I was more interested in them. But it was quite an amazing experience, and I'm still I will be collating that as a kind of visual report for the funding that I got for the Churchill Fellowship. And the outcome of all this research is to use that as leverage to set up my own collaborative agency called Us. Don't contact me about it because it doesn't exist yet. But the purpose of it was, as someone working in the arts, when I was employed, I always, you know, I think I imagine, you know, applying to get to a higher level of, you know, like a head of learning. It never happened for quite obvious reasons. But I thought, well, it's like, why don't you, you know, instead of trying to, you know, sit at the table, create the table.
Yeah.
So if I'm a co-director as a black person, it's me and somebody else and we want to work in this organic way. Why don't you create the thing that you want to be and you want to work in a specific way? I need to create it. So, yeah, that was the kind of purpose of the research. You know, it was also incredible to be basically living in Chicago because it's an incredible city. If you haven't visited, I recommend it.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. And I think it kind of comes full circle of this idea of, like, I think we were all talking about earlier, this pressure to do things quickly for outcomes, short-term projects, and actually things take time, and fostering relationships, as you're all doing, and communities take a lot of time.
I was also going to say that you're right about communities actually are the problems. They solve problems much better than any government or, you know, some of those structures, you know, solutions around housing, whatever it may be, or, you know, greening spaces. They're always coming from, you know, the ground up. Yeah. And more money should be invested in. I think they're the innovators.
Absolutely. I'm just going to ask you one more question before we turn to the audience to see if anyone has a question. And it's a little bit different, but I just thought I couldn't help but not mention that in 2 weeks' time, we'll be having a general election here in the UK. Looks like the Tories will be out after 14 years in government. And I just wondered how each of you are reflecting on the future of the UK and how you're feeling, and doesn't have to be, you know, a long answer, but just how you're feeling about the idea that a change will come and what that change will look like if it does come. Sally, do you want to go first?
I suppose right at the moment, I'm quite glad that this is the UK and not some other European countries that I'm more worried about in some respects. I think that last year's Refugee Week, which was compassion, feels like an incredibly important word for what I like pray might be coming, a little bit more compassion, a slowing down, I think, so that things take time to heal and that there isn't, I hope that there's some space given for that to happen in communities all across the UK. Those would be my two big hopes, that there's more space for compassion and there's more time to heal, I think.
Thank you so much. Solomon?
I won't talk politically because I don't think I'll get very far in life if I do talk politically. So, but I would just simply say, I think Margaret Mead was saying, the only thing that's made a difference in society is a group of individuals. And we are the politics. We are the government. I think we give too much power away to these institutions and organisations. And I think, as you said, creating the alternatives constantly is what we're trying to do. So in a fair, just society, we shouldn't have to do the work of statutory, you know, but we do. We know there's a massive gap. So for me, I don't focus on that so much because I think, having gone through historically, you've only had two parties, you know, left and right, left and right, left and right, left and right. So when people get quite excited about democracy, I don't. And although there are some real positive things about living in the UK, I think people don't understand that the UK is the eighth most corrupt country in the world. That's in the world. So you look at Brexit, you look at, you know, all these kind of things. So for me, I'm just saying, yes, be happy, vote, do your vote. I'm not saying don't vote, do your thing. but take back your power. Be the government. Be look at yourself as the politicians, and how can you, you know, make that change in that way?
Thank you so much. Well, how about you?
I'm thinking in a similar way to you now. Instead of getting all delusional about, well, I don't watch any of the debates anymore because I can't stand it, but I'm trying to think in a more positive way in terms of what's happening that is positive, like you say about community initiatives and things that are happening on the ground, you know, ground up. And I just hope we move into a less divisive, toxic, you know, time. But as you say, I'm not, I think those institutional structures literally, they just don't work anymore. From what you say about the corruption, and I think it is going to become more about, well, it always has been about people power. So that's what I believe in now. I think those are the solutions. And like you say, people taking back their power collectively, we're probably got more strength in that than the actual politicians. That's what I personally think. So.
Thank you so much. Does anyone have a question?
Hello. I just feel like we're in a very interesting time because of social media. And I feel like what's going on at the moment in Gaza is a really big example of that. In terms of information sharing and what you're talking about, becoming a politician or, you know, having a voice, I feel like that's changed a lot. And what I find really interesting about the current election is that for the first time I looked at my partner the other day and I said, you know what? These politicians just sound so out of touch. And even Labour, which before I think you'd kind of look at and be like, oh, they're kind of, you know, in touch with one part of society. I feel like even Labour and Conservative are both just so out of touch. So I am just interested to kind of see how social media and, you know, how society is going to change in the next coming years with social media and how that dynamic will change with politicians, and to see really if they will continue to have that influence and power or whether that's going to diminish, and you're going to have, I don't know, more maybe uprisals or challenges from the public trying to challenge those old institutions or, you know, yeah, that's just my point. I don't know what the answer to that is.
I think, you know, I think it's really about creating the alternatives. I think you can, so I do martial arts, and when you have certain types of martial arts, you create fights. You can only fight with an opposition. So if we constantly fight with power, then we are actually empowering them as well. So what I'm saying is, if you're not happy with the politicians, if you're not happy with it, I'm not dismissing anyone who works in politics and does great work, and I know there's great MPs. I'm not diminishing that, but create the alternatives. Create the alternatives. You know, I think historically that's been the people that we look for inspiration of how they've worked. So when we talk about great uprisings, it's the people. It's always the people. So I'm always like, I'm not dismissing. I live in the UK, so I'm part of the political system. I talk to MPs. I talk to, you know, I had Sadiq Khan rap one of my songs. So it's not like I don't engage. Yeah, like, cool. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, it was really cool. Do you know what I mean? But has it meant that I've procured more money for my project? No. So when you see things like that, when you have a direct connection with politicians on that level and it doesn't really change your trajectory as an organisation, you're thinking, so for me, always people. There's more people in this room that are really passionate about doing great, amazing social change. You know, I'm sure if we spoke to everyone in here, there's prime examples. And I just think we need to focus more on that. Myself personally, that's my personal take.
I'm quite enjoying it up here.
Anyone else want to take that?
Yeah, I was also going to say, similar to you, I'm not dismissing politicians, and I think I know people who are just like, I can't be bothered to vote, but I always think it's important to vote because I've met, you know, I've worked with, you know, refugee and asylum seekers who, you know, who've had been shot at for voting. And so I always think I can't be that casual about it. So I will always vote because I think it's important. As you say, I think it's, I can see it already happening, people doing alternatives to everything.
Jeremy Corbyn just went solo, right?
Yeah.
Oh, don't mention his name because then I'll start the kind of like, you know, how they treated that guy, irrespective of his politics.
Yeah.
Like, come on, man. If you've met this guy, if you've met him as a human being, he's a beautiful soul. I'm not talking about anything else. I've just met him personally. I can only judge, I can only judge people on my interaction, my energy, not what they say. Anyone can talk and lie. That's easy to come up and go, da, 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 da. You look at their body language. Jeremy Corbyn was, we were doing a martial arts, ironically, session, and everyone was kind of getting distracted. And I was like, what's going on? And I was like, it was Jeremy Corbyn. Now, this is, I just base it on the micro behaviours of people. I just see someone with that amount of press and that amount of power could have easily been like, Jeremy Corbyn's coming in the building. He just come in stealthily, quietly, do you know what I mean? And then everyone realised who he was and then started chatting to him. Those, to me, are really examples of more than a politician, of a human being. And that's what I like. I like human beings before the title. It doesn't matter, politician, you know, whatever you are. But the acts of humanity is what I base my connection with people to as well. So it could be a politician, because there are good politicians that demonstrate acts of humanity. But as a big entity working collectively, it's a bit, I'm trying to be polite as possible. It doesn't work. So what do we do? What do we do? And if you're going to vote tactically, you know? Don't not vote. Vote tactically. Be clever with your votes. Sorry.
No, it's okay.
Jeremy Corbyn's someone close to my heart. And I'm like...
That's okay. Yeah, I do think a lot of people are going to vote tactically. There are some really amazing politicians, like my local MP is Nadia Whittam, who, bizarrely enough, she was actually in a youth-led programme that I used to run. So I've known her since she's 13. So to me, it's kind of like somebody that a lot of young people really admire. And if I mention anything to young people about MPs, it's, Nadia Whittam's great, not interested in everyone else. You know, so there are, and she's stuck to those principles. And she comments on all kinds of shit all the time, so she's never going to change. So for me, it's, like you say, it's like the human being, the individual that I'm interested in rather than the title and what they're going to bring to the table. So the alternatives are definitely out there, and I can see people doing, you know, now. So I think people are ignoring politicians. And like you say, they decided to sort of take action in their own micro level, whatever that is.
I think it needs a bit of both. I think some of the terrible things that have happened need to be taken apart, and they need to be taken apart at a level that I'm not sure that locally that can be achieved. I've got the opposite. I've got an MP who is very despised and quite well known as someone who's really disliked quite a lot. A Conservative MP called Richard Drax. I think that some of that power really needs to be wrestled out of people's hands. And I think, and I know where I am, I think some of the stuff that's happening at a grassroots level is fantastic. And that is no doubt the most important change at a kind of human to human level. But I think some of the structures that have been put in place, the ways that people are expected to live in, you know, deeply inhumane ways, that needs to happen at a higher level, because that's where it can happen. So no amount of protest has got rid of the Bibi Stockholm. No amount of kindness and generosity and fantastic conversation and amazing collaboration as you know, between the guys and the town has enabled that to kind of fall. So I do think that those two things have to happen together. Yeah.
Huge thanks to the artists and Counterpoints Arts for joining us for this special episode. If you'd like to learn more about any of their work, you can find links in the episode description. And thank you for joining us for another season. We'll be back as usual next week with more episodes from the Arpsis podcast.